A new device called the PowerBlock becomes Dakota State University's first patent. And a question, are you getting enough sleep? It's Tuesday, March 9th, and this is In the Moment. The PowerBlock draws power from the batteries of a powered wheelchair or mobility scooter. It allows users to charge smartphones, power nebulizers, or even heat lunchboxes. Dr. Justin Blessinger has been granted a provisional patent for the assistive technology device. Dr. Chris Olson has been testing the PowerBlock. They join us later this hour. What about me is the question being asked by teenagers who are watching adults get vaccinations for COVID-19. Laura Rohde talks with some of those teenagers in a feature this hour. Plus, in their own words, and sleep. I'm Steve Swemke in for Lori Walsh. The news is next on SDPB Radio.
I'm John Wynn with SDPB News. The Open Fields Bill has been resurrected, amended, and passed in the South Dakota Senate. House Bill 1140 puts restrictions on game, fish, and parks officers entering private land. The Senate Judiciary killed the bill in committee last week, but the full Senate smoked the bill out the next day and voted on an amended version on Monday. Victoria Wicks has been following this legislation for SDPB.
The Open Fields Bill, in its original form, limited game, fish, and parks access to private land without permission of the landowner. The bill also said any evidence gathered and arrests made are invalid if conservation officers didn't abide by the law. The amended version removes the exclusion of evidence and arrests and clarifies that conservation officers can enter private land with a warrant. Senator Gary Kamek speaks in favor of the amended bill before the Senate votes on it. He says tensions between landowners and game, fish, and parks in the past led landowners to completely cut off all recreational access to their property. But he says game, fish, and parks changed its policies more than 10 years ago and repaired those relationships.
This bill codifies how the department has essentially been operating based on the current policy. This policy has been in place for over a decade. The policies can change over time, and to preserve good policies, codifying them makes common sense legislation.
The bill's primary critic has been Senator Art Rush, a retired judge. He speaks against the bill once again, saying that the amendments don't eliminate confusion.
If the department wants to have this in their regulations, in their rules for their employees, nobody has any trouble at all. But once they put this in the law, then what does the judge do where it says the game warden can't enter the property, but he did enter the property, but there's no consequence for it?
Senators passed House Bill 1140 by a vote of 21-14. The bill now goes back to the House for approval of the amendment. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
The South Dakota Senate wants to decriminalize marijuana for adults over the age of 21. Voters legalized both medical and recreational pot with ballot measures last November. Implementation of the recreational cannabis program is delayed because of legal challenges. Republican State Senator Blake Curd authored the new amendment. The Sioux Falls Republican says the last-minute measure respects what voters said in November while the state implements a medical marijuana program.
It allows the will of the people to be said and heard, at least to some degree, but it also gives the Department of Health time to develop the robust medical marijuana treatment program that they have stated to us on numerous occasions that is their desire to do so.
The proposal strips the Class 1 misdemeanor. It also removes the state's possession by ingestion of marijuana. Senators passed the bill with 31 in favor and 4 against. The bill now heads back to the House chamber, where lawmakers can approve the amendments or take it to a conference committee. South Dakota hemp farmers are gearing up for the growing season while lawmakers tinker with a bill that would allow them to plant a crop this year. A key change to the original bill would permit year-round applications to grow rather than a 60-day window. Another amendment lowers the entry barrier of 5 outdoor acres to half an acre and allows for indoor commercial greenhouses. South Dakota Industrial Hemp Association Vice President Derek Doman says dropping the 60-day application limit would provide a boost to the state's launch of the crop. He says he has been working with hemp farmers in North Dakota, Minnesota, and elsewhere to learn about the industry. Coming up next, it's In the Moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Hi, I'm Noelle King. With so much media out there, you are probably more bombarded by news than ever before. All of those news alerts on your phone. With so much news coming at you, it's really hard to know where to start. Morning Edition from NPR News has the day's most important stories reported and fact-checked by the time you wake up, from voices that don't shout for your attention. Listen every weekday.
Join us weekdays at 5 a.m. Central and weekends at 7 a.m. Central.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
Hey, South Dakota, I'm Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage, and we're proud to be on SDPB Radio Saturdays at 6 p.m. Central, 5 Mountain, and Sundays, noon Central, 11 Mountain. Each week, we feature performances from seasoned legends and emerging stars from across the USA and around the world, recorded in front of a live audience. If you agree that the world turns around a song, give us a listen. Saturdays and Sundays on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
SDPB's extensive legislative coverage includes, in their own words, hear debates and conversations from South Dakota's legislators. In their own words, is supported by SDN Communications. More at sdncommunications.com. Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwemke in for Lori Walsh. Sleep, getting enough to stay healthy. It's essential and can ward off serious health problems. Sleep is also being spotlighted during the pandemic. Just before the pandemic began, In the Moment host Lori Walsh visited with Darla Klinger, the lead sleep technologist at the Avera Sleep Lab. The conversation begins with Klinger explaining how common the issue of lack of proper sleep really is.
Very common. We're finding it to be more and more common all the time. The most recent statistics that I looked up was an estimated 50 to 70 million adults in the U.S. are affected by a sleep disorder of some type. And of those, at least 30% of those are suffering from insomnia. So It's very common.
And I'm just going to warn our listeners, some of this information is going to get a little scary as we realize how important this is. But we're also going to leave you with solutions and ways to sort of tackle this problem head on. But let me just ask, how does it affect our bodies? Because we're learning more about that, and the news is eye-opening.
Yes, well, the negative effects of sleep deprivation or just not getting enough of the necessary sleep that we require leads to decrease in productivity and decision-making, impaired memory and cognitive brain functions, reduction in our reaction times and motor skills, impaired vision, exaggerated moods and emotions, and there is a greater risk of injury or automobile accidents. So that's just the beginnings of the problems from sleep deprivation.
And one of the things I think people kind of forget is just what it does to your confidence as well. Because I know when I haven't slept, I forget things. And then I start wondering, am I forgetting things because there's something wrong with me? Am I forgetting things because I'm getting older? And pretty soon you're in this sort of mental cycle. And really what I needed was a good night's sleep.
Exactly. Yep. And so many of us put sleep off. We don't make it a priority in our lives, and so therefore we do suffer when we aren't getting enough sleep.
Are there long-term implications if you have a chronic, you know, because if poor sleep could be a week, it can be, you know, you have a newborn, and before you can get some support in your house, but you sort of know that's a temporary thing,
right.
Or that it can be addressed and you can get some assistance. But what if it's just part of your life and it's a chronic condition?
Yeah, the bad news is that lack of sleep, there's been a lot of research done, does lead to some very serious health consequences, and those include impaired cognition, again, memory difficulties, difficulty just thinking clearly, high blood pressure, and an increased risk for heart disease are very strongly connected to a lack of adequate sleep, an increased risk for stroke, weight gain, which leads to diabetes oftentimes, higher levels of anxiety and worsening of depression, And an increased risk for breast cancer has also been directly linked to lack of sleep.
And nobody wants to hear any of that,
nobody
Darla.
Nobody wants to hear it, but it is true.
But there we go. There's the facts. Why weight? Why weight gain? Why would not sleeping cause weight gain?
They have just found that lack of adequate sleep leads a person to be hungry and eat at times where they wouldn't normally be eating and consuming bad stuff. Typically, we make bad decisions in the food that we eat when we're tired, and so it just leads to weight gain.
All right, so as a sleep technologist, how many times, not to criticize doctors, but it occurs to me how many times I've gone to the doctor with a complaint, or I've heard somebody else who has a complaint they take to the doctor. Doctors don't necessarily ask you how you're sleeping at every visit, and it almost right. seems like that would be a really good thing to know as it relates to any other health condition. Do you find
Very
that
much.
People come to you and that nobody has asked them before, or that it
yes.
took them a really long time to get to sleep is a question?
Yes, unfortunately, we have heard that story where it took them 5 different doctors to finally get them into the sleep lab to figure out things. So it is unfortunate. The general practice physicians, primary care providers, often aren't given very much information while they're going to medical school, although that is changing. I am seeing a trend and improvement in that, and more of the primary care providers are asking those questions. So it is becoming more relevant in primary care practices, but it's taken some time to get that way. I've been at this for 25 years now, and we're just finally starting to see that kind of a trend. So it is improving, but it still happens sometimes that they aren't in tune to what the person is complaining about is related to sleep problems.
Right. It can be one of those questions that, I know somebody asked me the other day, how's your sleep? And it just, the light bulb went on. And I was like, it was terrible this week. And then for me, because I don't have any chronic, that was a really easy fix to the problem I was having. For other people, not so easy of a fix. So I want to talk about just some basic sleep hygiene stuff for those of us who don't have serious problems, but, might, want to be addressing how their sleep is. But first I want to talk about the sleep lab itself and people who come to see you. Who gets to that point? When do you know that this, a visit to the sleep lab or visiting with a sleep technologist is going to be something that can help you? When does it get to be like, I have a problem, I need to talk to someone?
Well, oftentimes they develop those chronic health conditions and they're going to the doctor frequently. They're seeing rises in their blood pressure that no matter how many medicines they're on, it's just not taking care of it. So oftentimes it's related to those chronic health conditions that can come about because of poor quality sleep. But sometimes it's just, I am so tired. I wake up in the morning after a full night of sleep and I just cannot function. I'm just so tired. I'm so sleepy. I'm falling asleep at my work and I'm on the verge of losing my job. It's those kind of complaints that sometimes will finally bring them in to see the doctor and get sleep testing done to see if there is a sleep disorder present.
For people who are intimidated or nervous about sleep testing, walk us through what that process is.
Well, you do have to be seen by a physician or a provider, a healthcare provider, to determine that sleep testing is necessary, because if insurance is involved, they want to know that they're paying for an expensive procedure that is actually necessary to determine the patient's problems. So
right.
You wouldn't want to talk to the healthcare provider or a sleep medicine specialist about the problems that you're having so that they can determine that, yes, a sleep study is necessary. And then there are 2 different ways of doing sleep testing. We can do an out-of-lab or a home sleep test, and that's becoming more and more popular and actually reimbursable by insurances. Or we can do an in-lab sleep study where you come into the sleep lab, we hook you up to a lot of recording devices, and then you sleep in the lab with us watching attentively to make sure that you are still breathing, your oxygen levels are still good, your heart is working right, and we can get to the bottom of what your sleep problems are in the lab too.
tell me some success stories of, just generally, I know you can't talk about individual patients, but when people identify this as a problem and do the work that needs to be done and get the right diagnosis and the right treatment, it must be a remarkable transformation for some people.
Oh, yeah. We have many people tell us it's totally changed their lives. It's made a complete 180-degree change in the fog that they were feeling. They no longer have that fog that they were living with, and they just feel 110% better because they found the problem, they were given the right treatment, and the treatment actually does work for them.
Let's talk a little bit about what we can do for better sleep, some of those tips. Where do you want to begin with that?
Well, those sleep hygiene, just like our own personal hygiene is important in making us, keeping us healthy and making us feel good about ourselves, so does our sleep hygiene. And that's just the practices that we do to get better sleep. And those would include keeping the room dark. The room that you sleep in should be dark. That itself promotes the melatonin secretion, which allows our brain to go to sleep. And so room darkening shades or an eye mask, if that's what it takes to make the area dark for you. No TV, no clock. I know that's hard. We've got lives we have to get up for, but if you can place your clock so that you can't see it every time you wake up and stare at the clock and know what time it is, that's in your best interest. And the TV is the same way. A lot of folks like to sleep with the TV on, but it really does hinder getting good quality sleep. Earplugs, if necessary, to keep out the noises that if you live near railroad tracks that, trains go by or disturbances outside, earplugs would be helpful. Avoiding caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol, and not eating a large meal at least 3 hours prior to bedtime. All of those things will impair our ability to sleep well. Don't exercise within 2 to 3 hours of bedtime. That getting your adrenaline up will hamper the body's ability to relax and go to sleep. And turning off all electronics, television, computer, phone, at least a half hour before trying to go to sleep. All of our electronics cause our brain is set on a light and dark schedule, and those lights, no matter how dark the area is around, and even if you turn your phone to a darkened nighttime setting, that still emits a light that tells the brain it's time to be awake.
Yeah.
Go to bed at the same time and get up at the same time every day, even on the weekends, so that you can maintain a nightly routine for bedtime. All of those things will prepare us for a good night of sleep.
I want to ask a couple questions that came in to us earlier in the hour and see if this is something that a physician would need to answer, if this is something that you have some experience with as well. And one of them was about melatonin and someone who was taking a pill to help them sleep, but it also had a mood stabilizer in it called ashwagandha. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but they were wondering about whether that could affect their thyroid. And somebody else was asking about vitamin D, and how much, whether they should take it all year long, and how much to take. So could you speak broadly about supplements and sort of how they fit into this whole, to your work as a sleep technologist?
Well, supplements can be very helpful. They really should be done at the direction of a healthcare provider, though, because if you're taking other medications, our supplements can have, even the herbal types of supplements can have a direct impact on the way your medications work in your body. And so I just usually direct any kinds of those questions to the primary care providers, because they're going to be the ones that are best able to decide if the supplement is going to be helpful to you and not a detriment to any other medications or things that you might be doing.
And one of the points that I thought was interesting about that, with how many questions we got about those sort of things, was just how often people are really looking for a solution to this problem.
Most people with sleep disorders, especially those with our sleep breathing disorder that we see the most in the sleep lab, CPAP is the treatment of choice for that. Most people would rather just take a pill. And so it's
CPAP,
it's
for those who don't know, is this machine that you would sleep with a mask on, right?
Correct.
Okay,
to keep your airway open so that you don't stop breathing during your sleep is what obstructive sleep apnea is. And so everyone wants to take an easy, if I could just take a pill for it, I'd be more likely to do it. And sometimes dealing with our sleep problems isn't as easy as just taking a pill. There's a lot more that might be going on that we aren't even aware of because we're sleeping when this happens. And having a sleep study helps us get to the bottom of a lot of those things too.
Darla Klinger is the lead sleep technologist at Avera's Sleep Lab. She spoke with In the Moment host Lori Walsh last February. There's more to that segment. You can find it at sdpb.org/news or by following the In the Moment segments podcast. Well, it's like you're right at the state capitol in Pierre, in their own words. It's next on In the Moment. This is In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
South by Southwest would normally kick off right around now down in Austin, Texas. Going to be online this year, which is less.
What's the point? I mean, I can see a name on a Zoom call, but I know nothing about that person other than that they're there.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Can it and we survive another year of virtual events? Talk about that next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
State House coverage provided by Boyce Law Firm, committed to our clients and building lasting relationships. A broad scope of services from personal injury to commercial disputes. Expertise you can rely on. Experience, integrity, community. BoyceLaw.com.
If you are responsible for your organization's marketing strategy, I'd like your attention for a moment. When you underwrite with SDPB, you are not purchasing airtime or a sponsorship. Your investment makes it possible for us to continue telling stories that are important to South Dakotans. SDPB listeners are more likely to be in upper management, have a valid passport, and save for their retirement. These are the people you reach when you underwrite with SDPB. Email us, underwrite@sdpb.org.
Program funding is provided by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City, offering a broad range of insurance products to protect you and your family at every stage of life. GeneHufford.com.
In Their Own Words brings you closer to the debates and conversations behind legislative topics. It's supported by SDN Communications.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwemke. Throughout the legislative session, we've brought you inside the chambers of the State Capitol Building in Pierre for our series called In Their Own Words. In today's installment, lawmakers debate House Bill 1248, which requires reports regarding the intentional disposal, destruction, or other disposition of human embryos. Let's listen.
We are now on 1248 as amended.
Mr. Speaker.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, members of the House. Well, I'm honored to be before you today to discuss House Bill 1248. Here's the bottom line. If a human life is intentionally destroyed in this state, then the state, at the very least, has an interest in knowing about it. And that's exactly what this bill is about. Now, I think there's been a bit of confusion on this bill. Some, sadly and unfortunately, have thought that this is some sort of attack on families who have used IVF or maybe even the IVF industry generally. And that is just, I gotta say, absolutely the wrong impression. Nothing could be further from the truth. I can safely say, I think, that nobody on this floor, including myself, is interested in using the heavy hand of government to tear down the IVF industry in South Dakota. This bill, quite simply, is about the state's interest in knowing when a human life, and in this case, human embryos, are destroyed. And what I'm about to tell you is true as a matter of scientific fact. A human embryo is a human being, period. Just like everyone on this floor was once a little 12-year-old kid, just like everybody on this floor was once a little toddler, everyone on this House floor was once at the stage of development that we're talking about in this bill. And if destroyed then, you wouldn't exist now. So back in 1992, the Fertility Clinic Success Rate and Certification Act was passed by Congress. That act required that all U.S. fertility clinics that perform assisted reproductive technology report data to the CDC annually on every IVF procedure performed. So clearly, the government found that the country has an interest in knowing and tracking information related to the creation of human life. That was the right idea then, and it's been on the books for almost 30 years now. So the information that's already collected is pretty broad in this area. But there's one really important thing that I think is totally neglected in these reports, probably the most important thing. And that's the total number of human embryos that are intentionally destroyed by a facility in these states. And I do want to be clear that this isn't some abstract concern. I've met with some doctors who represent the facility in South Dakota that does assisted reproductive technology. I was told firsthand that embryos are destroyed in our state, which led me to the introduction of this bill. So the bill simply says in subsections 1 and 2, if you're going to intentionally destroy a human embryo, whether the destruction occurs in this state or whether you send it out of state to have it destroyed, that the state simply has an interest in knowing about it, and it should be reported. Just like we require reporting on every abortion that occurs, the destruction of human life in this context ought to be reported as well. And then subsection 3 requires reporting of all embryos that are shipped out of state, so that if a facility tries to avoid admitting to the destruction of embryos intentionally by, you know, like storing those embryos out of state initially, we'll at least be able to see that they're shipping those embryos out of state in a possible attempt to avoid the reporting requirements. And the bill, it really is that simple. The bill has the support of many pro-life groups. The bill has the support of our pro-life governor. And I just want to note a few final things. The information reported is required. Thank you very much. The information required to be reported is totally anonymous. No information that's identifying is ever made public. There's no interference with a doctor-patient relationship in this bill whatsoever. This bill doesn't prohibit any activity whatsoever. The bill simply fills a massive gap in our reporting requirements. The bottom line is that if a human life is intentionally destroyed in our state, then the state simply needs to know about it. I hope you'll agree with that and support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks. 1248 is amended. Representative Kynes.
Question for the prime sponsor.
State your question.
What do you intend to do with this new information you're requesting that can't already be done with the data reported to the CDC and readily available online?
Representative Hansen, would you like to answer that question?
Sure, Mr. Speaker. Representative, thank you for the question. Well, I don't have any specific intent about what I'd like to do with that information. I don't know what the report would say. I would love it if we got this information and the number came back a big giant zero. I think that would be great. So we just don't know, but we require information, good information, as a legislature in order to set good public policy. So I'm only one of 105 members, so that would be more of a question for the whole body, not just for me, but I don't have any specific ideas as to what to do with the information. I just think it's important anytime a life is intentionally destroyed that the state has an interest in knowing about it.
Thank you.
Follow up, please.
Yes.
So if we want to know what's happening with all the embryos created in our state, why don't we track all embryos, including those created by a sperm and an egg joining inside a woman's uterus, rather than only those created in a lab?
Representative Hansen, would you like to answer that question?
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, thank you for the question. Well, I'm not looking for that information. I'm only looking for information on embryos that are intentionally destroyed. And so whether that's inside the womb or outside the womb. So if an embryo is intentionally destroyed inside the womb, then the state already receives that information. That's in our abortion statistics. But where the massive gap exists is embryos that are destroyed outside the womb, which I will remind the body, are human lives at our earliest form of development. That's all we're after. We're not after anything else in this bill.
Permission to make a few remarks?
Granted.
Thank you. This bill discriminates against families struggling with infertility by placing extreme government mandates on their ability to grow their families with the help of reproductive science. Approximately 1 in 5 pregnancies end in a known miscarriage. Researchers believe that that number is probably more like 1 in 2 because most miscarriages happen before the pregnancy is known. It is extremely likely that you or someone you love has suffered a miscarriage. Why does this matter to this discussion? Because by tracking all embryos created to help treat infertility, we are not factoring in that perhaps half of all those embryos would not survive. That's no one's fault, no one's bad action. But our state's lone fertility clinics seeking to help people with infertility will be held accountable for embryos that are not viable, with the assumption made that they are doing something wrong, perhaps something criminal. We don't know the future intent of this legislation. The prime sponsor just said and declined to say, is the intent to criminalize embryos created but that don't survive or are not viable? That's potentially 1 out of 2 embryos, whether that's in the uterus or in the lab. IVF creates life. If you claim to be pro-life, how could you oppose IVF? Families created through the miracle of reproductive science spend thousands of dollars and endure numerous medical procedures to have a child. If that has come easy for you, congratulations. But why would you deny other people the joy of parenthood? Personally, becoming a mother has been the greatest privilege of my life, and I bet most of you feel the same about your children or will if parenthood is in your future. Some of you met my 4-year-old daughter when she and my husband visited the legislature a couple of weeks ago. What you may not know is that Amelia is here because of the miracle of IVF. You are all essentially strangers to me, and I don't enjoy sharing one of the most personal aspects of my life with you, but I might be the only IVF parent in this chamber, and I'm willing to fight for others to have the same opportunity that my family has had. My family is complete. This bill will not affect us. Maybe it won't affect you either, or maybe it will. 1 in 8 families struggle with infertility. Men are diagnosed with infertility as often as women. Maybe you'll need IVF to create or grow your own family. Maybe someone you love will. It's almost certain that a child you already know is only here because of the miracle of IVF. The sponsor refuses to say if his efforts are designed to end IVF and won't even say what his intentions are at all. How can you vote for a bill without knowing what the end goal is? To say that embryos are intentionally destroyed, as the sponsor did, intentionally disrespects the science of IVF. The sole purpose of IVF is to create life and
bless my three
families. Placing the heavy hand of government on our doctors who are making miracles for South Dakota families is a cruel and an invasive move that has the potential to end IVF in this state. If you care about life and if you care about families, you will vote no on this bill.
Further remarks? House Bill 1248, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As a legislator with healthcare expertise, I knew there would be some tough decisions in front of me, especially being a Republican. In most areas of conflict, I've anticipated, but this is one area that I struggle with. The fact is that we don't know the intent, what future ramifications this type of bill is going to have on our vulnerable families of IVF. I personally cannot support this because I do not know what the intent is and what this information is going to be used for. I appreciate the work that the amendment that representative from prime sponsor has brought forward. I do think it is helpful, however, does not solve the problem of the fact that we do not know what this information is going to be used for. And if this information was valuable in improving healthcare outcomes or improving reproductive medicine, this information would be more readily available. However, it doesn't serve that purpose. So I'll be voting no. Thank you.
Further remarks, Representative Soy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just wanted to respond in kind of a rebuttal to one comment that was made that is likening miscarriages to the active destruction of embryos. As someone who has experienced a miscarriage early on, I can tell you I did not choose for that life to end. I did not actively make the decision that that child would not live. This is totally different from choosing to destroy an embryo in a lab. The state has a very important interest in protecting the lives of its citizens and needs to know when each citizen is intentionally killed.
For the remarks, Representative Deutsch.
I also serve as a legislator with healthcare experience. This, I just need to reiterate, is a reporting bill. I don't, for the life of me, understand how this discriminates anyone. This is simply the clinic reporting that a life has been terminated. Now, when a life is created in the test tube or the petri dish, the parents have a couple of options. They can have the excess embryos, and usually there are excess. They can have the excess embryos donated. They can have it transferred. They can have them frozen. They can have them implanted. They can implant more than one. Or they can have them destroyed. That happens all the time. And simply if the option of the parents is to destroy the embryo, then this bill would require that it be reported. Nothing more, nothing less. The reporting would happen, likely, without the parents' knowledge. I agree with the sponsor that the state has a vested interest in the life of children. And we track all kinds of data points. I don't see anything nefarious about this bill, anything discriminatory against this bill. I just think it's additional knowledge. And since when are we afraid of information? Since when are we afraid of knowledge? That's what informs us. That's how we make decisions based on data and knowledge. So this is just additional data points to help us understand who we are as a society. So I urge your support.
Thank you, Representative Duba.
I'd just like to make a few comments. Thank you.
If you may, go ahead.
I just heard an individual say all of the situations that an individual or a family goes through when they encounter IVF. Well, I'm fortunate. You know, I had three children of my own, and I didn't have to go through that process. How lucky am I? But I've had several friends who have. And one of the when this bill was coming up, they spoke with me specifically, and they said, if we make the decision to take those frozen embryos and destroy them, that is our personal decision. This is a very difficult thing that families go through, and I think we're losing sight of that fact in the need to rush to report. These are families who are not able to have children in the natural way. And so they go through this process and they have to make decisions. And so I think for us to ask that that be reported is completely out of line. And quite frankly, it's not the state's business. Thank you.
Thank you. Question for the body's final passage of House Bill 1248 is amended. Those in favor of vote yay, those opposed nay. Madam Clerk, please unlock the voting machine and would the members proceed to vote.
Mr. Speaker, all members have voted.
Please display the vote.
Mr. Speaker, there were ayes 47, nays 21, excuse 2.
House Bill 1248, having received a majority vote of the members elect, is hereby declared passed.
The bill passed the House and moved on to the Senate. During a hearing in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee on a vote of 5-1, the bill was referred to the 41st legislative day, which means the bill was lost. You can hear the complete hearing testimony at SD.net. Follow the South Dakota Legislature link in the meeting archives section. Details on the Power Block next as we check in with professors at Dakota State University in Madison. That's after the break. You're in the moment on the listener-supported SDPB Radio.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Why are people still dying of preventable diseases around the world? A doctor who treated Ebola patients in Africa lands on an answer.
It can be boiled down to othering people and then extracting from those other people, whether it's in the form of slavery or colonialism.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Turbach Law Office in Watertown. Attorneys handling insurance and personal injury claims, willing to work hard for injured people and their families. Learn more about the attorneys at turbachlaw.com.
SDPB brings you the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament. You can catch all the action Thursday, March 11th through Saturday, March 13th. For more information, including multiple ways to watch the games live, go to sdpb.org/basketball. Complete coverage of the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament is brought to you by Dakota Bank and SD Corn.
Program funding provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting Voting Why It Matters, featuring virtual events with authors, activists, and scholars, including Gloria Steinem, Louise Erdrich, and Thomas E. Patterson. More at sdhumanities.org.
Science and technology reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwemke. Dakota State University is celebrating the work of Dr. Justin Blessinger for what is believed to be the first patent granted at the school in Madison. Blessinger is the director of the ADAPT Lab at Madison Cyber Labs and a professor of English at DSU. He joins us by phone this afternoon. Dr. Blessinger, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you. Also with us is Dr. Blessinger's colleague, Dr. Chris Olson, an associate professor of information systems at DSU. Dr. Olson, we're glad to have you on board as well today.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dr. Blessinger, let's begin by having you tell us a little bit about your creation, and then we'll kind of get into the why and the conversation that you had with Dr. Olson that breathed life into this project. Go ahead and tell us what you've developed.
You bet. So what we've worked on is a device that plugs into a powered wheelchair and mobility scooters. And what it allows us to do is to create a host of new devices, the flagship of which allows the user of the chair to power really any device they wish. But obvious devices would include smartphones and heated fabrics that can make winter, especially in our northern states, a lot more tolerable. But it would extend to other devices as well, such as portable nebulizers.
Really interesting. It sounds almost kind of like a smart power strip.
Well, indeed, right. So the chairs run on 24 volt. And so that was our first challenge was just making sure we could step it down to something that was a lot more common. You know, most smartphones and so on are charging on 5, mm-hmm. and other devices are usually around 12. So that was our first challenge. And, you know, the device really kind of came out of a series of conversations between Dr. Olson and I. And Dr. Olson uses a powered chair for mobility, mm-hmm. and had expressed to me some of his frustrations with not being able to keep warm during the winter months here in South Dakota, and that sometimes limited his desire to go out in the elements.
Yeah. Dr. Olson, can you maybe expound, too, on the conversations that you had with Dr. Blessinger prior to the development of the power block and the patent?
Yes, very much. And it's been, you know, kind of a great invention, but I have plates and screws that are holding my neck together. And as Dr. Blessinger mentioned, the South Dakota winters aren't very kind as far as causing neck pain. So I was talking with Dr. Blessinger and thought about having, you know, a heated scarf that I could take with me, because they made battery power scarves that didn't hold a charge very long, and of course things that you could plug into. But I wanted something that was portable to help me get to and from campus comfortably and anywhere else I travel outdoors. And the heated scarf sounded like a great plan. And that's when Dr. Blessinger came up with the idea that we could tap into the power of my wheelchair. And it's worked wonderfully in the last couple of years.
Really good plan. Dr. Blessinger, DSU being a smaller campus, have you and Dr. Olson put your minds together in the past or maybe worked on any special projects before this? Are you pretty close colleagues?
We are indeed. And Dr. Olson is a tremendous asset both to our research together and to the campus at large. His skill with coding in a variety of languages and app developments and so on has been just a great asset to what we do. So because we can now power devices, we've begun working on a range of sort of smart devices that might facilitate other help. So, for example, we're very near to being able to open proximity doors, the accessibility doors that have the great silver button that you might see on your day-to-day, and also to call elevators just using your smartphone. So that would be a way to help people who have maybe some mobility limitations, but also just the rest of us. There's been plenty of times when your hands have been full and you just wish that door knew to open as you approached, or that the elevator knew to be called. And so those are some devices we're able to work on as a next step, using the power block as our sort of foundation.
That's really interesting. And I'll put this question out to both of you. Dr. Olson, you can answer this first. How long have you been testing and using this device? And how long do you have to put it through the paces before you can apply, apply for a patent?
Well, I will leave the patent application up to Dr. Blessinger. He's done that all on his own. But, as far as the conversations Justin and I had, that's been a couple of years ago, and I've been using the power block for at least two cold winters that it's really helped me out. But I'll let him mention the patent process, because I know that he went through that himself and was successful.
Yeah, Dr. Blessinger, go ahead.
Right. The patent application was really new to campus. DSU has certainly been an innovator in all things software, security, and so on. But patents generally require that the software has a system involved, or perhaps a hardware component. So we just haven't done as much in that realm. And of course, you know, anyone who's been alert to DSU's rapid growth in the last several years under President Griffiths would be keenly aware of how we've really started to stretch in new directions. And that's really what the Mad Labs facility recently built up here is all about, is allowing faculty to really pursue research goals that in the past have been a little bit more difficult to attain, sometimes because of space considerations, sometimes because of funding. So we applied for the patent late last year, probably October, and it took about 2 months to get the provisional in place. And now we have a year to finish filing for the what's called the full patent, which gives us many years of protection of the innovation, both for the university and for people to be able to purchase it, and for anyone who might wish to license the technology to be able to sell it commercially.
Sure. I in the press release I got from Dakota State University, it was talking about the labs there, and we talked about the ADAPT lab at the beginning of our segment. I heard that there was something like 16 different labs on campus, and not necessarily a building being a lab, but is that true?
Yes, the Mad Labs facility houses, I would say, probably 15 or 16. There are a few that are not in that facility, and that's really for reasons that are unique to each lab. Mm-hmm. But this was a kind of a crowning of achievement for Dr. Griffiths bringing this research facility here to campus, because of commercial applications that we're starting to see with patents like ours, but also all of the software applications and security applications that are starting to come from our research in that lab. So it's an exciting place to work. The lab in which I work is sort of a honeycomb of other labs, the area in which I work. And because we're adjacent to other researchers and other workers, it's really quite a blessing to be able to turn around and talk to somebody whose specialty is penetration testing or security. Because if we're working on a device that has to do with helping people use their smartphone for greater accessibility, we're not experts in that area and making sure the device is secure and that their personal information is able to be secure. But right next door to us, we have experts in that field, and they have grad students and undergrads who are working on their projects. So sometimes we're able to share that talent as well and bring in students who are capable penetration testers that, you know, would also be used for the banking security work that we do. So there's some really talented undergraduate, graduate students here, and of course the fellow researchers that we get to work on. So the Mad Labs facility is really starting to come into its own here.
Thank you very much. And it's only been there for 2 years, is that right?
That's correct. The Adapt Lab is a bit older, although we didn't have a proper name when we started. Chris and I think, first started working on a device that would broadcast information based on where you are to help, especially people with visual impairment. And I think that was 2016 when we received a small amount of funding to develop a beacon-based information system. And it helped people just as they entered the doorway. It would broadcast who's in the building, what kinds of services are here. I like to use the example from courthouses because I remember the first time I read on a wall, Department of Equalization, and I had no idea what that was. So, you know, the nice thing about our systems is that they're universally accessible. That is, they're useful to anyone, regardless of whether or not you might have a visual limitation. But it's, of course, providing information that goes beyond just what a sliding letter board would do for those of us who are sighted. We can read the location of the office, and we can read the name of the office, but still not know what it does. And, of course, a system like we were developing in 2016 allows information to be shared that's far beyond the simple title and location.
It's all very interesting. We have just a minute left. Dr. Olson, I wanted to ask you, where on a power chair or a mobility device is the power block located? Where do you put that on? And you already talked about some improvements you see for it. Any others that you might want to have Dr. Blessinger research before this is all finished up?
Well, the good thing about it is all power chairs, at least all the brands that I've encountered, have the same type of charging port. And so the charging port is right kind of where my joystick is, where I use my controller to drive my chair. And then the power block mounts to the side of my wheelchair, so it's in great close proximity. Dr. Blessinger even made me a special keyboard tray that, 'cause I'm in a wheelchair and I can't, I don't have use of my hands, so I type with plastic sticks, and I have a keyboard tray, so it sits across the arms of my wheelchair, and that has the plugs or power adapter plugs. It's kind of a customized power block that he made for me, but it makes it easy to charge my phone. My wife was very excited when there was talk of rolling blackouts a couple weekends ago. She knew that we would have power for our mobile devices, even if we lost electricity. So, just some amazing amount of things that we can do with the power block.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry we have to end things right here, but I really want to thank both of you for joining us, Dr. Justin Blessinger and Dr. Chris Olson from Dakota State University, talking about the pending patent for the power block. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
To date, the COVID-19 vaccine has not yet been approved for individuals under 16 years of age. So what do South Dakotans under 16 think about this? SDPB's Laura Rohde visits with them to find out.
After hearing about close friends in their 70s receiving their COVID-19 vaccine, my husband and I began visiting about how nice it will be when we and the rest of our family and friends are vaccinated against the disease. That's when our 10-year-old daughter interrupted our conversation. "What about me?" she yelled. "When can I be protected?" This outburst made me wonder, what do young South Dakotans think? As the adults in their lives anxiously count down the weeks until they can receive their dose to become mostly protected from COVID-19, those under 16 still don't know if that day will come anytime soon. I began by asking our daughter Parker to further explain her feelings.
"Well, Mom, I won't be able to get it for like 1,000 years. Well, I was sad because you guys would be going to all sorts of fun stuff, and I would just have to stay at home.
Up to this point in our family, the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted Parker the most, because until recently, we chose to remote school her, and that's been tough.
I couldn't go to school, and I couldn't see many of my friends.
Because she has severe asthma, 14-year-old Autumn Locker and her parents also chose the remote school option offered by the Sioux Falls School District fall 2020. But the isolation became too much for this self-identified extrovert, so the eighth grader masked up and returned to Edison Middle School in January. With asthma, she feels as though she's at high risk if she contracts COVID-19, so the news that she is 2 years too young to receive the vaccine is discouraging.
I was definitely disappointed because I'm at the high risk end of things, and so is my mom. So I was kind of disappointed, but I understand their caution because they haven't done enough testing to make sure that it's safe for little kids. So I understand, but I am a little sad.
Unfortunately, the medical community does not know yet when the vaccine will be available for youth under 16, explains Dr. Kara Bruning, Clinical Vice President of Pediatric Services for Avera Medical Group.
I have two kids in school as well, so I totally understand. But we're doing our best to get those studies performed so we can vaccinate our children as well and get over this hump.
Yeah, I'm just ready for things to be back to normal.
Kalei Vasquez is a high school freshman, and she would be attending Sioux Falls Roosevelt High School. But instead, because of COVID-19, she and her older sister are remote schooling. And it was difficult for Kalei to learn that her older sister, Deleth, is eligible for the vaccine, but she is not.
At first I was like, I didn't really understand why I couldn't get it.
The person Vasquez is most eager to see receive the vaccine is her grandma, who lives with them.
Like, I have my grandma here with me. And if she gets the vaccine, I don't know, I feel like there's a less chance she'll get it. So there's nothing that I could bring back to get her. And since she's like a little older, I've always been scared that she's like, I don't know, that if she gets it, she won't make it.
Even after Vasquez's grandma, parents, and sister are vaccinated, to protect children and others yet to be vaccinated, Dr. Bruning says those who are vaccinated need to continue wearing masks and practice social distancing to protect those who are still waiting to receive their dose.
Our numbers are getting better, but there's always that chance. So everyone still has to make their own decisions right now, but at this point, we still recommend masking and social distancing.
So even after the vaccine, our lives will not bounce back to before COVID-19 times right away. But at least we can feel many times safer engaging in activities we enjoy as a family, with masks on and socially distancing, of course. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Rohde.